This is Mae Warren. Today is the 23rd of February, 1996, and I'm in Lexington, Virginia with President John Elrod at Washington and Lee University. But we're not going to talk about being president. We're going to talk about being dean. You came to this place at a really interesting time into a very interesting position. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start by asking what probably seems like a very simple and silly question. What does a dean do? What are the responsibilities of a dean?
Well, my job as dean was to be responsible for the academic program, the curriculum, and the faculty, to put a fine point on it.
Well, now, come on, aren't you going to expand upon that a little more? What does a dean do day by day? How were your days occupied?
Well, I can't help but compare it with this office. This office is quiet by comparison. In a way, it's like a sleepy little street, whereas the dean's office is a very busy intersection through which passes on a weekly basis almost every aspect of the university, at least with having to do with student life, academic life, faculty, academic programs. And it is a extremely busy place, which if you're not careful, will leave you little, if any, time to be reflective and proactive, because so much of what a dean does is just reacting to what walks through the door. But my day would be spent, it would begin every day at 8 o'clock with John Wilson. And John and I and the associate dean, whoever that happened to be, and in my time it was Pam Simpson, then Tom Williams, then Larry Batch, then Lad Sessions. Each of those served 3 years, though Pam was at the very end of her time as associate dean when I got here. In fact, she served 4 years. But we'd sit for an hour, and we'd talk about the upcoming business of the university, pending business of the university, or we would talk about books or music or sports. Conversation would occur every day that the three of us were in town, which I'd say was 4 days out of five, and it ranged over a very wide range of topics. Then at 9 o'clock, the day would formally begin, and I would have appointments with department heads, appointments with faculty members who wanted to come and talk with me about particular problems that they had or things that they were trying to accomplish. Sometimes I initiated those appointments, sometimes they did. Department heads were usually rattling a tin cup and asking for money or plotting a strategy as to how to deal with a difficult problem that they were dealing with in the department, sometimes curriculum, sometimes person, sometimes personnel. I had a fair number of people coming through my office from outside the university, alumni, parents, representatives from other schools who and colleges who were here trying to find out something about Washington and Lee in order to make a comparison with the institution from which they came. I would spend a fair amount of my time in committee meetings. I've never stopped to think about it, but I would say maybe at least 25% of my time out of my office in committee meetings, and by committee meetings I mean the standing committees that I served on, a chair. The ad hoc committees, of which there were many over my time as dean, and also then in a variety of departmental meetings, sometimes the whole department or sometimes a subdivision of the department. I would spend a fair amount of time on the telephone, talking with my fellow deans in the law school and in the commerce school, and it will come as no surprise to you to hear me say that there were problems that cut across all three divisions, and especially in my later years as Vice President for Academic Affairs, I would initiate conversations with those two deans who were working on a policy which was going to have university-wide implications for the faculty. I spent not as much time as I would have liked talking with students. who would come in with academic problems or sometimes looking for money to support a speaker that an organization that this student represented was trying to bring to campus. For example, John Branham was in my office as president recently trying to scrape up enough money to sponsor Cornell West's visit, which, by the way, was superb. So I often saw students in that context. And then I guess the other major block of time in the office was from 5:30 until 7:30 or 8 o'clock when I cleaned out my inboxes. And as you know, the inboxes that one has, or that I had, have grown over the years. I started out with what we would now call just a hard copy inbox, just correspondence. But then I had after a while, as did everyone else, an email inbox, which my practice was to deal with email first, then the regular inbox, and then phone mail. So I would try to get all of that done on a daily basis by 8 o'clock in the morning, so that then my day was free to do all these other activities which I've been very generally describing to you.
Yeah, those electronic things have complicated our lives, but boy, I sure find them useful.
Oh, I do too. I'm not complaining. But it just, in terms of that block of time from 7:30 to 8, it seemed like it was more time consuming because I had more things coming in.
Yes.
Not just memoranda, not just letters, but also then email messages, which sometimes were nettlesome and complicated, and but they had to be dealt with just like a memorandum does. So but from an administrative point of view, what all this has done is simply make the administrator more accessible, and it gives people more people a claim on his or her time. And when I was trying to get everything of that sort done between 5:30 and 8 o'clock, it just meant I had to work, I felt like anyway, harder in that period of time to get it all done. Let me just clarify one thing when I said that the president's office is a sleepy street in comparison to the
I figured you probably would want to do that.
What I mean by that is, and this has been, I suppose, the major surprise for me in my transition, though we're not going to talk about the presidency, is that the dean's office is incredibly filled every day with all kinds of people and problems. The president's office, while it is not entirely predictable, is more predictable on a day-to-day basis than is the dean's office. And it has far fewer people coming in it, because technically the president now is not technically, but in fact, at the top of the pyramid, and those people who easily have access to the president on an ongoing basis are those people who report directly to him. And that is far fewer people to whom I'm accountable than all the faculty and many students, which is the case when you're the dean. The problems are a different sort. They are more policy-type problems. They're more far-reaching. They are less amenable to quick fixes. Mm-hmm. And they often require more more contact and collaboration with a wider range of constituencies than when you're dealing with a problem or an issue as dean.
That makes perfect sense. Now, when you arrived on campus, it was I suppose there's never a boring time at Washington and Lee,
yeah,
but it was a particularly dramatic time.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm thinking of co-education was in its birthing process. Am I right when you arrived?
Well, it was, the baby had been delivered. When I arrived here on the 12th, I think, of July, having driven over 2 days from Ames, Iowa, and that trip, we did not know whether or not Mimi and our sons and I did not know whether or not we were coming to an all-male institution or a co-ed institution, because we were actually making the trip on the weekend that the decision was made by the Board of Trustees. And I distinctly remember getting to our house, 207 White Street, about the middle of Sunday afternoon, and I had not seen the house, by the way. Mimi had decided to buy a house while I was in Iowa. She came out to look for a job and didn't find a job, but she came back and had done everything but sign on the dotted line to buy the house. So I'd come to a new house as well, which I hadn't seen, but which I liked very much. But that's beside the point. So we were standing there in the front yard. Lash LaRue, who is an alumnus and wonderful professor of law, ambled across the street, and my first words to him were, I knew him. Did we come to an all-male institution or a co-ed institution? Because I did not know. And he told me that we had come to a co-educated institution. So that's what I mean when I say that the baby had been delivered. That next year, of course, we were planning for the transition to co-education. Pam Simpson, the associate dean of the college, and my colleague, chaired that committee, and she was in the thick of it in terms of preparing for the transition to co-education, and she was working with a committee of faculty and administrators, and this may sound strange to you, but that was kind of something that was happening across my suite of offices, because I did not get myself involved in it very much. I wanted to get to know the faculty very well, and to learn the curriculum, and to learn how the place worked politically. And I knew that that was going to be the same whether it was all male or co-ed. And I thought that this is how I must spend my first year. So all the preparation kind of happened to the side as far as I was concerned. Though Pam kept me up to date, and she and John and I would meet every morning, and we knew what was going on. But it was really to the side for me. My more interesting challenges were the faculty's hesitations about me. And I had come from the Midwest, even though I'm a native Southerner. I was an unknown, really, to the faculty. John Wilson had been here only 18 months, and he had stirred up co-education. And he was still basically unknown, too. He was also from the Midwest. John may have told you we were known as the Midwest Mafia.
No.
The two of us were called that. Yeah.
No, I hadn't heard that.
I, at an early administrative meeting at Skylark in September, October, right after I'd arrived, had said, in this group, when I was asked, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I think the faculty is a little sleepy. And that word got out to all the faculty that I had said that they were not asleep, but a little sleepy. And so that put me a little bit more on the defensive. So what I was really concentrating on in that first year was, well, just to repeat myself, trying to get to know the faculty well, trying to absorb what this curriculum is all about, and simply trying to understand how things got done.
What did you mean that you found the faculty to be sleeping, and what did you do about it?
Well, you will have to be discreet in the way that you handle this. I'll try to say it as carefully as I can. The faculty, when I say the faculty, of course there are going to be exceptions here, but the faculty didn't put as much value as I thought it should on research and publications. And I thought that the faculty was content to do a good job in the classroom, but they weren't, and they were strongly tied to the institution, but I didn't feel that the faculty was pushing itself and trying to advance their own scholarly commitments and responsibilities, and I didn't feel that the faculty's had as strong a commitment to its profession, or to its discipline, I want to say. Its academic discipline, is I felt a strong commitment to the institution, but not quite as strong a commitment to, say, doing scholarship in English literature or doing scholarship in philosophy and knowing who your colleagues are out there nationally who are important and writing the important books and articles and reading those and trying to respond to them and trying to be innovative and original yourself. That just wasn't a front burner kind of issue for the faculty. And I thought it should be. So that's one sense in which I met. And the other sense was the faculty I thought needed to be tougher with itself with respect to making sure that high standards of scholarship and teaching are articulated and preserved when it comes to making judgments about whom is to be hired, whom is to be reappointed, whom is to be promoted, whom is to be tenured. Those are profoundly important issues with respect to the overall quality of the faculty. And what few people understand is a dean doesn't have a lot to do about that. It's really the faculty that handles these matters. And the only way that you can, that the dean can get the standards jacked up and then a willingness for the standards to be enforced and maintained with respect to these personnel decisions is to try to get the faculty to do it for itself. And I think there was less of that than I thought would be appropriate for an institution of this quality.
How did you go about that? Did you light a fire? Was there a meeting?
You just start talking about these things. Mm-hmm. First, I will put it this way. I had a record myself. I was proud of the fact that that I had two books published by Princeton University Press on Kierkegaard and a number of articles, and I had some considerable activity in a number of professional organizations. All that was profoundly important to me with respect to what I wanted to accomplish for myself as an academic. And I brought that with me, and that was known. I then just began, whenever I had a chance, talking about the connection between scholarship and teaching. And I profoundly believed, by virtue of the experience I'd had in the philosophy department at Iowa State University, and I believe this to this day, that a faculty as a whole has a better chance of being an outstanding faculty if the faculty as a whole, of course they're going to be exceptions, but also have their own academic interests and passions which they pursue with great commitment and determination. And I'm just convinced that the best teaching faculties are faculties that have passions that take them out beyond what they have to do to be very well prepared for class. And you've just got to really care about your field, and it has a kind of magnetic attraction to you, and it demands time and energy and commitment and thought. And so that's what I tried to talk about. And I'd do it sometimes with department heads. I'd do it one-on-one. I would often say to a faculty member, have you ever thought of applying for a National Endowment for the Humanities summer stipend or these NEH research fellowships for a year? Fantastic. Or you haven't been to a professional meeting, did I hear you say, in a year or two, look, here's some money. Go to the APA or go to the MLA and encourage wherever you could people to write papers to present at professional meetings, and tell them that you'll cover their research costs. We had a little Glenn Grant program here which supports summer research, and it was spending about $18,000 or $20,000 a year when I got here. Now it spends $100,000 a year. We had the R.E. Lee program, which was giving money away, or I will say allocating money for students to do less than serious research at any time during the year. And we changed that and we said, now look, we're going to take this R.E. Lee money, we're going to put it all in one pot, and we're going to give it to students in the summer who can get proposals approved, just like faculty. If they don't get proposals approved, they don't get the money. But if they do, they get a nice stipend, which they can put in the bank, plus room and board, so that when they finish, they've got something to show for their summer. So a research product as well as some money. And it just, then we also formed a committee to rewrite the promotion and tenure guidelines. And that forced the faculty to, I won't say forced, but invited the faculty to think seriously about, well, what are our standards for tenure and promotion? And really, what should we be expecting of ourselves in the classroom? And how do we know when a person really is a good teacher? And what evidence is there? And what should we expect with respect to scholarly output? Are we going to be a publisher parish place? No, we're not, and we aren't now. But if we aren't, what kind of expectations are we going to have for scholarship? And how are we going to measure those? And how are we going to support young faculty who come here and have a desire to do research, but have teaching, heavy teaching loads? How are we going to support? So this redrafting, new set of promotion and tenure procedures forced us all to rethink what the standards ought to be for this, and how to go about measuring them, and what counts as evidence. And that whole process took 18 months to 2 years. And so maybe it was just a collection of a lot of little things, not any one thing, and not any one big moment, that just, I think, over time changed us. And now what we find, I'm happy to say, is a faculty which is serious about scholarship, which does a good job at it, which puts great pressure on the administration for support. And this is especially noteworthy in the young people who are now being hired, who are pushing us hard for example, a leave program during the probationary time for tenure-track faculty members. That is, we have a rule now, no one who is untenured, even if you're tenure-track, is permitted to have a paid leave. You've got to get yourself tenured, you've got to pay your dues, and then we'll give you a leave. Well, now we've got these young faculty saying, look, you want us to do scholarship, you want us to do research, we have a passion for it, we've got the bit in between our teeth, help us to do this, give us some time. Make sure that we get funded in the summer. Help us to write grant proposals. Give us the opportunity to take a term off during our probationary time at just the right point for us to get a good chunk of research done so that we'll have more to show when the time comes for us to stand for tenure. So it's all of those things and probably more. And that it's wrong, too, for any one person to get the credit for it. I mean, leadership out there in the faculty, the department heads are fantastic people, and they got the spirit, and then they began pushing it. And much harder for them to do that than for me, because they are right down there in a department with people who are living with changing standards and new procedures. It's kind of easy for the dean to do that, because he doesn't have to brush up against people every day who are having to go through this. And it is a little bit frightening for most, not all. But those department heads are right there, and they took the leadership, and we've really made some, I think, great progress in those last 10 years.
You're a very easy interview. I don't even have to ask the questions, and I get the answers I want. I'm interested to hear you say that no particular credit is due anywhere. Because one of the things that Frank and I have been talking about a lot is something called the Leyburn Plan. And are you acquainted with the history of the Leyburn Plan?
I know the name of it. And I know Frank thinks that it has been implemented over time. But I confess to you that I read it when I got here and didn't think about it again. And so I couldn't tell you, probably in the way that Frank has, exactly which aspects of it are in place and which aren't.
But he very much thinks that you've brought it into fruition.
Really?
And that James Leyburn would be very thrilled with what's come to pass here. But But I'm curious about, and in fact, Frank is going to be doing some going back and talking to people who were there at the time the labor and plan was presented, whether the labor and plan was considered, was called the labor and plan at the time, or whether that's sort of what it's become over the years. Will we look back at this 10-year period as the Elrod plan?
I don't think I had a plan. I'm not an administrator in that sense that I come in with a full-blown plan. I didn't have one. All I knew when I got here, based on my own experience, was that I thought teaching was a profoundly important factor in the success of our society, and I thought you needed smart people doing it who love their fields and who love students, and whose lives revolved around finding out things and telling others what they found out and helping others to figure out how to find out things. That's kind of what I had when I got here. And I learned in my time here a lot about education, a lot about teaching, a lot about the relationship between scholarship and teaching, because this institution was different from the institution that I came from, a state university with 25,000 people. It was different, very different from my undergraduate institution. Different, maybe not very different, and which was a distant memory to me. And so I just think that my 10 years here, I would say, was a, from my point of view, a nice mix between my talking to the institution, if I can put it that way, and the institution talking back to me, and something coming out of that conversation which seemed to work and make a difference, and in the long run, I hope, improve the institution. So people wouldn't, I think, say the Elrod plan. No. Laban came from Yale. He had a plan, and he had been here 5 minutes before he started talking about this plan. I admire that way of doing things. It's just not my way. I suspect Frank is right. I suspect we have pretty much realized what he had in mind. But I'm just not that way. I'm more a tinkerer, I guess. Just sort of going from one day to the next and being guided by a few large ideals, but not having an Elrod plan. I would have never dreamed, for example, that I was going to work as hard as I did, and that the college would be as successful as it was in putting together the interdisciplinary aspects of the curriculum, which is a lot of has happened in that area. It wasn't remotely in my mind that the sciences were in trouble and needed work. And I didn't even know that until after I'd been here 2 years. And
tell me about that.
Well, the Oberlin College has a very good institutional research program. And they were trying to do some research which they could use to convince the National Science Foundation that the teaching colleges in the United States, the better ones anyway, were producing a higher ratio of their graduates, were causing a higher ratio of their graduates to go to graduate school in the sciences than were the large universities, public and private. In other words, you understand what I'm saying? As a percent of the graduating class at Oberlin College, more students were going to do PhDs in the sciences than that percent of Ohio State University, both in the same state. And so what they were doing is a lot of detailed and intricate research to show that this was so. And in the process, they developed a set of criteria, 4 or 5, which they thought could be used to really rank the top liberal arts science departments in the country. There were 50 of them, and Washington and Lee was not even on the list. Mm-hmm. And I can remember when I read that, and I kept looking and looking and not, just I just couldn't believe that we weren't there, and we weren't. And so we had a lot of work to do. We had to build a new building. We had to build a new complex. We had to hire new faculty who had a commitment to the laboratory and to doing research in the laboratory. We had to hire faculty who were committed to doing research with undergraduates, and we had to find undergraduates who were interested in science and would be willing to do research with faculty. We had to increase by a tremendous number of dollars, the external funding that we were drawing to the university to support our teaching and research program. And we had to increase the number of students who graduated from Washington Lee who went on to do PhDs in order to get into the company of these top 50. And so we went to work on that. And we developed a 5-year recruiting plan to increase the quantity and the quality of students studying science, and we stopped it after 3.5 years because it was so phenomenally successful. We built a $22 million science complex. We did a very good job of hiring young faculty who came here with the idea of teaching science through research, and who thought that the way in which they could most effectively teach, especially their majors, is by drawing them into their laboratories and having them help them to do their research. We've done an excellent job in supporting the development of faculty through our own funds. We've done an excellent job in creating 2 new science programs, a cognitive science program and a neuroscience program, both interdisciplinary. And we've done a very fine job, I think, of encouraging all science faculty to establish research programs whose outcome were publishable articles, and who saw all of that activity as essential to what they were doing as teachers of undergraduates. But I couldn't have dreamed that was going to be important when I got here. I wouldn't have dreamed that it was important to do Russian studies, to strengthen East Asian studies. I wouldn't have dreamed that we needed to computerize language instruction, and that we needed $500,000 from the Pew Foundation to do that. I wouldn't have dreamed that we needed a phased retirement program to try to provide incentives for our senior faculty to move out of teaching in a way that didn't make retirement so threatening. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm saying to you is I think, at least for me, before you set up big plans, you let the institution speak to you about where it is and what it thinks it is and where it wants to go, and then you just kind of respond to it as best you can.
Well, that's certainly what I'm doing these days.
You sure
I can
are.
Identify with that.
You're doing a lot of listening, like right now. I'm sorry my answers are so long. I'll try to shorten
them. No. It's wonderful. It's a sign of a good interview when my name doesn't appear. You also mentioned a few minutes ago about strengthening the interdisciplinary aspects of the school.
Yeah.
Tell me about
departmental that. Departmental boundaries and disciplines are, up to a point, justified. But when you get beyond that point, they're arbitrary and unrealistic. And for example, if you take biology and chemistry, and you get at the introductory level, you can teach an introduction to biology, you can teach an introduction to chemistry, and you can spin off those introductory courses, the subfields, physical chemistry, organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry. And you can do the same in biology, botany, neurobiology, field biology, all the others, human biology, reproductive biology. So that their distinctiveness makes sense at a certain point. But the more sophisticated disciplines get, I'm going to say biology and chemistry get, the closer they get to each other. And so it struck me that one of the ways to keep life interesting in an undergraduate college is to, wherever you can see, faculty from across disciplines looking at each other and beginning to talk to each other. Here is new territory. Here are new colleagues. They're not just your departmental colleagues, but they're colleagues in another department. Here are new courses. Here are, in a way, a new field. You get Ed Cron teaching medieval literature, and you get George Bent teaching medieval art, and then you create a medieval studies program, and all of a sudden, literature and art come together, and they create something new that's not quite art, it's not quite literature, it's both and more. And that happens all over the place in the curriculum. And I just thought that in a small institution where bureaucracy is fairly low level, where there's not a lot of administrative red tape, where you can see these sparks catching, then it's very easy administratively just to encourage it. And so that's happened. And we've strengthened the East Asian Studies program, we created a Russian Studies program, we created a Medieval and Renaissance Studies program, a Cognitive Science program, a Neuroscience program. And these are just new opportunities for faculty, new fields for students, and in some ways, and at a certain level, it's a clearer fix on what is, because these disciplines are coming together the way they really are together in the world of reality, whether it's a physical world, a mental world, or the aesthetic world. And so we just sort of took off in that direction as well.
That's exciting to me. My favorite course I took undergraduate was called Parallel Themes in Art and Literature. I had to go to a different school to do it, but I was so excited by the idea.
Exactly.
So I know exactly what you mean. And I still remember that course. Yeah. I can remember specific lectures in it, and it really was quite thrilling to bring those two interests together.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. It is very exciting for students, and most of these programs that have been created or strengthened have good, healthy enrollments and a decent number of majors. The only one that has not done well is cognitive science, and I think that the problem in that field was one of the keys to making the interdisciplinary program work is that you have somebody you hire somebody who is fundamentally responsible for the program and who can drive it administratively and from the standpoint of the curriculum as well. And we have that in all of these other interdisciplinary programs, but we haven't found quite the right person in cognitive science. We had, for 2 years, we had a visiting faculty member here. He was in the philosophy department and the psychology department, and he is a philosopher of mind. And if he had been able to stay, he probably would have brought the leadership to that program, which it still needs in order to make it the equal of the others, which I think are doing better.
All right. I know your time is precious. I have one last question I'd like to talk about. And it's something you mentioned in your lecture, and I think it's something that's really come to be in that the 10 years of your deanship. There are a lot of women on this faculty.
Yeah.
Tell
when
me
I got,
about
when I
that.
Got here, Pam Simpson was a tenured member of the faculty, as was Nancy Margan. They were the only two tenured women. Two tenure-track women came with me in the same year, 1984, in Romance Languages. There were a couple of other women, one in art, who was on a part-time basis and temporary. one woman in English who was temporary, and one in the library. And as soon as we co-educated, we realized we had to make progress in this area and as fast as we could. And so what we agreed to do was to not sacrifice quality, don't hire a woman just because she's a woman. But when all other things, when the best person is a woman, it's an open and shut case. When all other things are equal and it's a male and a female, hire the woman. And so we now have close to 30 tenure and tenure track women on the faculty, still not as high a percentage by a long shot as we need, but we are tracking well with the institutions that we compared ourselves with in their first decade, Princeton and Davidson. And we've had about the same percentage growth in terms of women coming to the faculty as those two institutions. We've hired mostly newly minted PhDs, appointed women at the junior level. We've made a couple of senior appointments. And in the years ahead, we're going to have to make more senior appointments. And for two reasons, you don't want all of the women to retire from the faculty at the same time 30 years from now, assuming most of them will be tenured. So we need to spread it out a little bit. And we also need more senior women to provide leadership on the faculty. And you can get instant leadership with the right senior appointment, female or male. So I think we'll see a little bit more of that in the years ahead. Yes, but we're not co-educating the faculty as rapidly as we're co-educating the student body, but we're making good progress, and it is a high institutional priority, and we'll stick with it for as long as it takes.
Well, it's very nice for me to see faces of my gender and my age around here.
Yeah. Well, they're wonderful teachers. You know, we are, I think, at about 45% of the PhDs produced annually are now female. 35,000 PhDs a year, which is a grotesquely high number. The market can't absorb them all, at least the academic market can't. We need really to cut back tremendously. But even if we were to do that, I think we are going to see a continued growth for a while on the female side, and I won't be surprised when we hit 50%. So it's all, not a major challenge anymore to hire women just because they are almost 50% in the market and in the applicant pool. Now, that's true when you take them all together. When you go and look at physics or at mathematics or even in my own discipline in philosophy, it's not 50-50 or 45-55 by a long way. Maybe in philosophy, maybe I'd guess 15 to 20%. In physics, it would be less than that. In engineering, less than that. In English, it's probably over 50%. In art, it's probably over 50%. So we're going to see parity, male-female parity on the faculty in certain departments before we'll see it on the faculty as a whole. We already, I think, have it, or right at parity in Romance languages. Mm-hmm. 6, I believe, males and 5 females. I think that's right, or if it's not right, it's close to it. And we're making great progress in English as well. And in art. So yeah, it's coming along quite well.
I'm going to flip the tape over.
Okay.